So we've come to the last part of the Isaiah scroll, and it's composed back in Yehud, Judah, in that little bit thatched area in that map. It's all the southern part of Judah, which is mainly desert, rocky desert, but desert. The Edomites had been chased west by the Nabataean Arabs, and then they kind of took over the southern part of Judah during the exile period. So there's not much left to Judah. Jerusalem in the north, and then it's landlocked, and it's in that area that our material is composed. Cyrus of Persia entered Babylon in 539 BC. He continued his policy of allowing exiles to return to their own country, and a small group of exiled, led by Sheshbazzar, returned to Judah, and you'll find the information in Ezra and the Book of Chronicles, which are from the middle of the 5th century. The foundations of the temple were laid, but the work was not continued, partly because of pressure from the Samaritans, who kept interfering and made it impossible to do it. Cyrus was killed in battle in 530 BC. His successor, Cambyses, was succeeded in 522 by the greatest of their kings, Darius I. This was an unsettled period with revolutions breaking out throughout the empire. In a book called The Hebrew Bible by Norman Gottwald, an American scholar, he writes this: "With the death of Cyrus's successor, Cambyses, a major uprising shook the Persian Empire. Cambyses was succeeded by Darius." And this is where our part of the world is interested. "As part of an effort to pacify the empire, Darius decided to launch a more serious drive to recolonize Judah as a strategic, military, and political salient on the frontier of troublesome Egypt." In 520, Darius sent Zerubbabel to Jerusalem as governor. Zerubbabel was the grandson of King Jeconiah, the one who'd been the young king who was taken into exile in 587. So, in 597, sorry. With Zerubbabel went Joshua the high priest. And if the historical record from the following century is accurate, they led a large contingent of around 40,000 exiles. That's in the book of Ezra. This is the period of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, who were hoping that Zerubbabel would re-establish the Davidic dynasty. However, any possibility of such a restoration was dashed when Darius I consolidated his control. This tiny little backwater didn't have any of the resources to revolt. The empire, the Persian Empire, remained stable throughout this time. And interesting, I've got the three emperors or kings: Darius I, Xerxes I, and Artaxerxes I, and the three of them went for a whole 100 years of reign. So long, stable periods of government. Yehud will never be anything but a little outpost subject to the Persian power. The Judah to which the exiles returned was a very different place from the Judah they'd been exiled from some 60 years earlier. The Edomites, under pressure from the Nabataean Arabs, had occupied southern Judah, and the population had been drastically reduced and impoverished. This is estimates made by Jewish scholars, archaeologists and historians, and these are the suggested. There's no better suggestion, so I'll offer it to you. The population of Yehud, when the exiles return, is estimated at 35,000. And I meant to look up what the population of Campbelltown is, and it's a lot more than that. So we're not talking about a big population. There were 75,000 prior to the exile. Now it's down at 35,000. Gives you a bit of an idea in here. They also estimate that 75% of the 35,000 population of Yehud had been there all through the... They were locals and they stayed local and they weren't exiled and they didn't return. About a quarter of the population were returned exiles. Not surprisingly, there were those in Judah who were reluctant to welcome the returning exiles. And you find that in Ezra and Zechariah in the Bible. They were not happy to hand back the land they'd occupied. The mixed population in Samaria, north of Jerusalem, didn't want to revert to having a strong neighbour on their southern border. So the zeal, and we've been witnessing that for a day, the zeal of the returning exiles, the ones that returned, were the ones that favoured the Isaian school and took up the challenge and dared to go home. So if you like, they're the best of them. Well, their zeal met with strong resistance, and their attempts to carry out their mission of rebuilding the temple were thwarted. The returned exiles of the Isaiah school continued to comment on, update, and rearrange the material now found in the Isaiah scroll 1 to 39. We've done that. They kept looking at all that and readjusting it, etc. They also continue to comment on, update and rearrange the material that we've just finished studying from Isaiah 40 to 55. So they're still working on updating the material. They continue to speak of the breaking in of a new age of salvation. We'll see this shortly. And if you compare Isaiah 62 with the opening words of Isaiah 40, you can see they're echoing it, keeping alive the powerful, encouraging literature of the exile period. They continue to speak of the central role of Zion in the promised new age. And they see their servant ministry as a continuing of the ministry of the servants of the exile. I've got some texts there. If you look up the website, you can find them written there and look at them for yourselves and see the parallels. The third part of the Isaiah scroll, which is our topic today, focuses on the internal wrangling of the community back in Jerusalem. These chapters don't have a single author. The exhortations and criticisms come from a minority movement in Jerusalem that's discontent with the way things are working out since the erection of the Second Temple, which did happen in 516. And the material seems to range from the return from exile, 520, through to the time of Ezra in the middle of the next century. So 60-70 year period of this section of Isaiah scroll. During the period, Judah was under a governor appointed from Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire. Now the first governor was Zerubbabel, we've mentioned him, but when Zerubbabel stops, there doesn't seem to be another one for quite a while. There's no record of anyone because, I suppose, the Persians were troubled by Zerubbabel, who's a grandson of their king, this messianic movement. They didn't want that, so possibly the whole thing was scrubbed. And in any case, the power now moves from the political governor to the high priest. That's where the high priestly power really, it becomes a religious government of the internal workings of the Jewish people. It's important to remember that from the Persian point of view, the Second Temple, it's very different from the First Temple. The First Temple was attached to the king's palace. It was a king's church or temple. And people went to it rarely, only on very special occasions. Now, the Second Temple is a bit like the pagan temples in the eyes of the Persians. And the pagan temples, as you know, were marketplaces, banks, trading. They were the general place where everything happened, including the gods. So the Second Temple is an instrument of Persian control in Judah. And it's under the authority of the governor, not the temple priests. And there are names of a couple of governors during this 70, 80, 100 years. Nehemiah will come in the middle of the 5th century as a governor. Those who composed the section we're looking at, Isaiah 56 to 66, have nothing good to say about the leadership, including the temple priesthood, and we'll see that. They rail against the prevailing religious compromise in the cult and the rampant injustice that contradicts the religion of Israel. So this is a common theme in Isaiah, in 2nd Isaiah, and now in 3rd Isaiah. What God wants, according to Isaiah 58:6, we'll look at it later, is, quote, to break unjust fetters, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, to break every yoke. That's their drive. Unsuccessful. However, they were not in a position to do anything about it, apart from complaining and continuing to point out the will of Yahweh as expressed in the Torah and the prophets. They shared the fate of those responsible for the section we've looked at, Isaiah 40 to 55, in that they were a persecuted and shunned minority. Things would change with the coming of Ezra in the middle of the 5th century, but that is a story beyond our present intention. The salvation hopes of the prophet preachers of the exile were not realized. Life in post-exilic Judah was defined by economic hardship, insecurity in political life, ruin and devastation, and the burden of continuing shame. Those who, back in Judah, carried on the mission of the prophet preachers of the exile blamed the community who failed to keep the Sabbath. Now that's an interesting development. We're going to see it shortly. The Sabbath is not mentioned in the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, and it's not mentioned in the exilic stuff. The Sabbath seems to have taken on an importance during the exile, where they had to identify themselves in some way. They couldn't by their king, they couldn't by their political power, they couldn't by their temple, and the Sabbath became the thing that identified them. They'd come together on the seventh day, the Sabbath, and read the scriptures, pray, comment, listen to 2nd Isaiah, all of that. That's a marvellous thing. We've got to find something like that ourselves again, that was actually communal but family stuff and didn't require priesthood or cult or anything. That became the thing that identified them, and it still does. It's kept Judaism alive, I think, all these centuries. So they're complaining here that they're not keeping the Sabbath. failed to observe dietary laws, had a false attitude to fasting, and were involved in immorality and idolatry. Especially to blame were those responsible for the cult in the Second Temple. However, the members of the Isaiah school continued the proclamation of salvation. The salvation would be a historical one, though Isaiah 60 and 65 speak in more transcendent terms, apocalyptic terms. The salvation would come on that day, like when God finally intervenes. But most of 3rd Isaiah, we'll call it, is about looking for a historical salvation in this world. Cult worship has a place in the promised state, though it's not stressed the way others are stressing it at the time. God would soon come and directly intervene. The material in this section of Isaiah's scroll is outstanding for its sense of the all-embracing, brackets Catholic, mission confided by God to Judaism. This tiny little backwater, but they keep insisting we've got a mission to the world. This is clear in the opening chapter's attitude to foreigners and eunuchs. The temple is supposed to be a house of prayer for all the peoples. That's the key line in there. It's a house of prayer, but it's for all the peoples. The Isaiah school is critical of the prevailing narrowness of the leadership in Judah. And we know from the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and Chronicles that when they went back, the bulk of them who were there already and then those who returned, they were scared of God and they wanted to make sure they kept the law completely right. So they had to get rid of any, all those who were left behind had to get rid of any Moabite wives, any mixed race children had to be banished. They wanted a pure Jewish thing. So it was a kind of a narrow focus on making sure we keep the rules. And the only ones speaking against it are the ones we're about to read. The disciples of the Isaiah school of the exile. The authors are critical of the compromises that are found in the cult, and they declare that fasting is no substitute for justice. There's the opportunity for a new beginning, for Yahweh bringing about a new creation, a term they love to use, a new redemption. Just a couple of texts to make a point. A comparison of the following text will help to illustrate the close connection between the third part of the Isaiah scroll and the part we've just done. Compare, for example, this is from, I'll call it 3rd Isaiah. I'll read it to you. It's in red there. See, your salvation comes, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. Isaiah 62:11. Compare that to this from Isaiah 40:10, exilic thing. See, Yahweh God comes with might. His arm rules for him. His reward is with him. His recompense before him. Very conscious of. Here's another one. Compare this from the section we're about to look at. The coastlands shall wait for me, for the name of Yahweh your God and for the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. That's chapter 60:19. And here from chapter 55:5, the exilic material, you shall call nations that you do not know, and nations that you do not know shall run to you because of Yahweh your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. A quote, an echo of the earlier material. So these final chapters, sorry for the long introduction, but I judged it necessary to get the feel of it. These final chapters of the Isaiah scroll have a special interest for us Christians because of the way they were appealed to in the early years of the development of Jewish Christianity. Just as the authors in post-exilic Judah saw themselves as the ones who were being faithful to the life and mission confided to Israel by Yahweh, and continued to point out the failures of the majority, so the Jews who followed Jesus saw themselves as the ones who were being faithful to their Jewish traditions by following the revelation they received through Jesus, the Messiah, whom they believed was sent by Yahweh to bring to its fulfillment the revelation contained in the Torah and the sayings of the prophets. So naturally they associated very closely with this Isaiah school in the post-exilic Yehud. They saw themselves, the early Christians, as the faithfully living out the mission given by God to Abraham, their father, as Paul calls him, their father in faith. If we were doing Paul, I would want to insist with you strongly how, because there are, well, I haven't seen them for a while now, but shocking stuff written about Paul. Paul was a Jew, loved it, died a Jew, never stopped being a Jew, wanted to be a Jew really, really, really. And he saw in the Christian community, in Jesus' Judaism, the way forward to be truly faithful to that long, wonderful tradition of Judaism. Just as those responsible for the section we're about to look at, Isaiah 56 to 66, kept appealing to the majority to be converted, so the authors of the New Testament, Paul especially, kept reaching out to their co-religionists to re-examine their traditions in the light of Jesus' life and teaching. Like the suffering servant, Jesus was scoffed at and rejected by the Jewish authorities. But again, like the suffering servant, in his patience, obedience, prayer, and love, Jesus revealed who God really is. And he opened Judaism up to the surrounding world, sending his disciples out to the nations to bring about the reign of God promised in the scriptures and to take the blessing given to Israel to the whole world, as Yahweh had promised Abram in the beginning. At last, the text, Isaiah 56, verse 1. Thus says Yahweh, maintain justice. They're right on it from the beginning. Do what's right. For soon my salvation will come. It's not apparent in Yehud, but it's going to come. And my deliverance, my redemption, will be revealed. Maintain justice. There's the Hebrew word, mishpat. It means judicial decisions made according to the truth, according to the evidence, not because of bribe or positions of authority or power or anything else. That's what justice is. It's a legal term. The decision that's made in the court is the truth. Do what is right, tzedakah, the Hebrew word, means acting in a way that's appropriate to one's right place in society. It's actually not quite the way we would look at it. We're very personal, and that's a good thing, this sense of the person. But that's pretty modern. Most people in the world today, I think, a bit of a generalisation, are more tribal than individual personal. So what the group does, they all do. And in this world of post-exilic Yehud, What is right depends on your place in society. So, and their society is highly structured. So what is right for the king is not right for me. What is right for the priest isn't right for me. What's right for me is not right for the priest or the king or the prophet. So they all, and what's right for a woman isn't right for a man. And what's right for a man is not right for a woman. It's an ordered society in which your place in it determines what is right for you to do, to keep the order. So back again, it's acting in a way that's appropriate to one's right place in society. It's related to the declaration of divine will, including the covenant, and is concerned with establishing, maintaining, and restoring order, as they saw it, divinely established order. Doing what's right results in peace. There's a lot of truth in that. The focus was very much on law and on the social effects of behaviour and on salvation. Meaning to my life. If I'm a farmer, then I behave the way a farmer should behave. If I'm an artisan in the town, it'll be quite different. There'll be constants, parts of the degree, but they're very different. The tzaddik, that is, the just person, is a person of chesed. Chesed is covenant love. So that's, if you're going to think personally, and they didn't think a lot personally, they thought communally more, but if you do think personally, then the person who is just is the one who keeps the covenant, trusts Yahweh, and keeps to Yahweh's ways. The disciples of the prophet, preachers of the exile, were concerned at the prevailing absence of tzedakah, acting in according to divinely established right order. The opening verse, which I just read, takes us to the heart of one of the most urgent concerns of the post-exilic disciples of the servant prophets of the exile, namely the concern for social justice. In this, they're in touch with a perception that's also at the heart of the religion of Israel. Yahweh is the one who hears the cry of the poor. Pretty well as close as you can get to a definition of Yahweh in the Old Testament Bible. The one who hears the cry of the poor. Who redeems people from slavery. That's their big story, Egypt. Yahweh is real, Yahwism, the religion of Yahweh, is real only when it's expressed in sharing Yahweh's response to the poor. And that basically was not happening, as we'll see. This attitude, this concern about justice, as I've tried to define it for you, perhaps more than anything else, is the glue that keeps the three parts of the Isaiah scroll together. It's the constant thread through them. The text, Isaiah 56:2. Happy is the person who does this, does justice, and one who holds it fast, who keeps the Sabbath. That's now become centrally important. We're not profaning it and refrains from doing any evil. And it goes on, do not let the foreigner joined to Yahweh, who's worshipping Yahweh, don't let the foreigner say, Yahweh will surely separate me from the people. And why would they think of saying it? Because every time they went to the synagogue, somebody said it. They heard it from the pulpit again and again and again and again. If you're a foreigner, you're not welcome. And these Isaiah people are saying, you are welcome. Don't say you're not. And don't let the eunuch say, the eunuch, I'm just a withering tree. I can't have children, so I'm not going to have anything. It's clear from this verse that there was a strong lobby that saw a key problem in any kind of communion with those who were not ethnic Israelites. They were pushing to exclude from the people, and so from the temple, and probably from the synagogue and the Sabbath, foreigners who adhered to the religion of Yahweh. The eunuchs mentioned in this are probably also foreigners. It was not a Judah custom. Foreigners, according to those wielding power in Jerusalem, eunuchs not only had no hope of children, but they should be deprived of spiritual communion with the religion in which they had been adhering. Move them. Text. For thus says Yahweh. It's not being said by the priests in the temple. It's not being said by the leaders. It's not being said by a lot of people. It's not being said by one nation. But to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbath, yes, there are requirements of them, and choose the things that please me and hold fast to my covenant, I will give, this is God, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than sons and daughters. I'll give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. This is powerful stuff, isn't it, really? So countercultural and so strong and so modern and so needed today. The members of the Isaiah school are fighting to keep alive the universalist view that they'd inherited. They're also fighting for justice for the oppressed. Text. The foreigners, in spite of what's been preached, the foreigners who join themselves to Yahweh, to minister to him, to love the name of Yahweh, and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath and do not profane it, yes, you have to fit in with the community, you have to be part of it, part of the social structure, of course. When you take your oath of Australian citizenship, of course you have to say, well, I'll stand under a government elected by the people, etc. You're not going to just stick to Sharia law or whatever. Those who keep the Sabbath and don't profane it and hold fast to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain. I'll make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices rejected by the religious authorities, but they'll be accepted on my altar, says God, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all the people. And you know that that text was chosen by the Christian community to give meaning and explain what Jesus did in the temple. It was not about coins. It was not about robbers. It was about people robbing God, limiting God to their little temple, as though there, that's it, that's where God is. Where the temple was meant to be a house of prayer, yes, but for everybody, not just for us. The focus now, it's a focus they learned in exile where there was no temple. The focus is on prayer. That is to say, on communal and personal communion with God that's not necessarily connected with sacrificial offerings. They're not against it, it's part of the culture. But something else has to be here. And everyone's welcome to be part of it. The text goes on, thus says Lord Yahweh, who gathers the outcasts of Israel. I will gather others to them besides those already gathered. Finally, there's no limit to Yahweh's love. For Yahweh will gather others to them. In this, as in other matters, they found agreement with the members of the Deuteronomic school who composed this following prayer that they put on the mouth of Solomon way back before the division. So you're supposed to hear, it's Deuteronomy's writing it, but you're listening to Solomon have this prayer. When a foreigner who's not of your people Israel comes from a distant land because of your name, for they shall hear of your great name, your mighty hand and your outstretched arm. When a foreigner comes and prays towards this house, he's just built a temple, then here in heaven, he prays, your dwelling place, do according to all that the foreigner calls unto you, so that all the peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your people Israel, and so that they may know that your name has been invoked on this house that I, Solomon, have built. We've only done 8 verses of the text, but we can move now more rapidly. Isaiah 56 verse 9 reads, all you wild animals, come to devour. Israel's sentinels are blind. They're without knowledge. They're all silent dogs that cannot bark, dreaming, lying down, loving to slumber. The dogs have a mighty appetite. They never have enough. They're supposed to be protecting the city. The shepherds also have no understanding. They've all turned to their own way, to their own gain, one and all. Come, they say, let's get wine. Let's fill ourselves with strong drink, and tomorrow will be like today, great beyond measure. Make Australia great beyond measure. The righteous one has perished, and no person who's a just person has just wiped off, they've taken the land and whatever. The righteous has perished. No one takes it to heart. The devout are swept away, and no one gives it a thought. It was on account of evil that the righteous one was swept away. He enters into peace. They repose in their final resting places. He was upright in his conduct. When did that enter the script? Is it telling us about the mentality of the school straight after the exile? Is it coming later when the idea of resurrection of the dead was emerging? I don't know. It's hard to find clarity in that. But it could be either of those. Okay, we're dealing with poetry, which is metaphor. This section we just read refers back to the Isaiah 52:13 to 53:12, the suffering servant. The lament is that the people are so blind that they cannot see the value of what they've rejected. The people are so evil, they prefer to continue their sinful life rather than listen to the prophetic word, change their behaviour, and enjoy Yahweh's promised blessing. There's a small section which I won't read. It's a critique of idolatrous cult, even in the temple, a familiar theme in Isaiah. And then comes a section on forgiveness is always possible. And I'm reading now from the text. Build up. Build up. Prepare the way. Remove every obstruction. from my people's way. Thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is Holy. I dwell in the high and holy place, and also with those who are contrite, broken, contrite, and humble in spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly, to revive the heart of the contrite. For I will not continually accuse, nor will I always be angry. For then the spirits would grow faint before me, for I made everything that breathes. We've seen a lot of God's anger. Here's God saying, look, I won't always be angry. And the text continues, because of their wicked covetousness, I was angry. I struck them. I hid. And I was angry. But they kept turning back to their own ways. I've seen their ways, but I will heal them. I'll lead them and repay them with comfort, putting words of praise on their lips of those among them who mourn. Peace, peace to the far and the near, says Yahweh. I will heal them. But the wicked are like the tossing sea that cannot keep still. Its waters toss up mire and mud. There's no peace, says my God, for the wicked. Isaiah 58 is a section on its own here, and it's looking at the proper perspective on cult, on religious practice. It's very beautiful. Blenkinsop, a wonderful author on this scroll and on many matters in the Old Testament. If you ever see a book written by Blenkinsop, buy it, because you'll actually be able to read it. It's written to be read. And this is what he says. The indications are that beginning in the Neo-Babylonian period, the approved kind of prophecy was becoming increasingly an activity of taking over, editing, commenting on, and updating existing prophecies. The period of direct prophecy was very much linked to the kings, because it was a critique, basically, it included the other, but it was basically critique of government. Now, that's here too, of course, but it's control. Now, when the kings are no longer there, that kind of relationship is broken. So when they can't blame the king for many things now, because they're sitting under the Persian king at Susa. They don't have a lot of power, the leaders. They're governors from somewhere else. So that brings a difficulty in. So the prophecy, according to Blenkinsop, saying, and he's right, is now more a matter of reminding and bringing stuff back from earlier prophets and, as he says, updating existing prophecies. Prophecy became, in other words, more scribal and exegetical, more a matter of inspired appropriation. How do we appropriate this prophetic statement of the Isaiah to us today? And interpretation of existing prophetic words deemed to be still authoritative and valid than a matter of direct prophetic inspiration. I think I might have spoiled all that with my interventions, but it's a very good statement, and it helps us shift what we're expecting from the prophetic writings of Haggai, Zechariah, and a lot of the other prophets, including this third Isaiah. Isaiah 58 is a particularly good example of this, for it draws on already existing prophecies and not only from Isaiah, as a way of demonstrating that the inspired teaching of the school comes out of acknowledged prophetic tradition. So they're not relying just on their own, they're bringing in 2 Isaiah particularly. So let's look at it. Isaiah 58. Shout out, don't hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Announce to my people their rebellion, to the house of Jacob, the leaders, their sins. Day after day they seek me, and they delight to know my ways, as if they were a nation that practiced righteousness and didn't forsake the justice of their God. They ask of me righteous judgments and they delight to draw near to God. And they say, why do we fast? But you, God, aren't watching. Why humble ourselves when God isn't noticing? Look, say the Isaiah in school. This is your problem. You might want to draw near God and you're always talking about God and you're always saying your prayers and you're always going to the temple. But look, you serve your own interests on your fast day. You oppress your workers. What's the point of being a daily communicant if you're oppressing your workers? Look, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to strike with a wicked fist. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. Is that the kind of fast that I choose? A day to humble yourself? Is it to bow down the head like a bulrush or to lie in sackcloth and ashes? Are you going to call this a fast, a day acceptable to Yahweh? Isn't this the fast that I choose? Loose the bonds of injustice. Undo the thongs of the yoke. Let the oppressed go free. Break every yoke. God help us, that's powerful stuff. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry? Bring the homeless poor into your house? Brackets. We should control our own borders, don't you think? People who come into our house, we decide that, we're told. Bring the homeless poor into your house. When you see the naked, cover them. Jesus would have read this. His parable of the Last Supper, of the Last Judgment, is pretty well straight out of here. And don't hide yourself from your own kin. Then, if you do that, wow, then your light will break forth like the dawn and your healing will spring up quickly. Then your vindicator shall go before you and the glory of Yahweh shall be your rear guard. Then you'll call and Yahweh will answer. You'll cry for help and you'll say, here I am. I'm with the blind man of Jericho. I'm with the leper. I'm with the thief on a cross. I'm with the broken poor people. That's where I am. All your prayer while you're doing all this injustice is going nowhere. If you do this, if you break every yoke, well, you'll call and Yahweh will answer. And when you cry for help, you're looking in the right direction, you'll hear him say, I'm here. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then Your light shall rise in the darkness. Your gloom will be like the noonday. Yahweh will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places and make your bones strong. You shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail. The woman at the well, John 4:14. It's all linked. The text goes on, chapter 58, verse 12. Your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. They're not rebuilt yet, but they shall be. You shall build again on foundations laid long ago. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to live in. If you refrain from trampling the Sabbath, from pursuing your own interests on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the holy day of Yahweh honorable, if you honor it, not going your own ways, serving your own interests, pursuing your own affairs, then you shall take delight in Yahweh, and I will make you ride upon the heights of the earth. I'll feed you with the heritage of your ancestor Jacob, for the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. Isaiah 59. I've put the Hebrew words there in brackets. I'm not going to read them out to you. It's just, if you notice, they keep recurring here and in the next few pages, but I'll leave that to your later imagination. See, says this disciple of Isaiah group, see, Yahweh's arm is not so short that it cannot save, nor his ear so dull that he cannot hear. Rather, your iniquities are worn. Your iniquities have been barriers between you and your God. Your sins, hata, your sins have hidden his face from you. God hasn't hidden his face. Your sins have hidden it, so that he doesn't hear. For why your hands are defiled with blood, your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have uttered what is untrue, fake news. Your tongue mutters what is perverse. No one brings to court justly. No one goes to law honestly. They rely on what's worthless and fraudulent, conceiving mischief and bringing forth iniquity. Their works are works of iniquity, deeds of violence. That's interesting, because the Hebrew for violence is Hamas. You've surely heard that. Hamas. Violence. The deeds of violence are in their hands. Their feet run to evil. They rush to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Desolation and destruction are in their paths. The way of peace they do not know. There's no justice in their paths. Their roads they've made crooked. No one who walks in them knows peace. Therefore, justice is far from us. Righteousness doesn't reach us. We wait for light and look, darkness. We wait for brightness, but we walk in gloom. We grope like a blind man along a wall, groping like those who have no eyes. We stumble at noon as in twilight, among the vigorous as though we were dead. We all growl like bears, like doves we moan mournfully. We wait for justice, but there's none. We wait for salvation, meaning, fullness of life, but it's far from us. Our transgressions before you, O God, are many. Our sins testify against us. Our transgressions indeed are with us, and we know our iniquities, transgressing and denying Yahweh, turning away from following our God, taking oppression and revolt, conceiving lying words, thinking that up, and uttering them from the heart, the corrupt heart. Justice is turned back. Righteousness stands at a distance. Truth, what a lovely line this is. Truth stumbles in the public square. Uprightness cannot enter. Truth is lacking. And whoever turns from evil is despoiled. Those who leak the injustice of government are shoved in prison. Yahweh saw it and it displeased him, and there was no justice. He saw and was appalled that there was no one to intervene. A comment. The prophet preachers stress the need for conversion of heart, and in particular, a commitment to justice. If people are genuinely repentant, their prayer will be heard. The darkness that they're experiencing is because they've turned their back on the light. God hasn't turned away from them. And the text continues, so his own arm brought him victory. His, God's, righteousness upheld him. He put on righteousness like a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on garments of vengeance for clothing, vengeance, power against the oppressor, and wrapped himself in fury as in a mantle. And I'm reading from Ephesians chapter 6, where Paul writes, and you can see where he got it from, stand therefore, fasten the belt of truth about your waist, put on the breastplate of righteousness, take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, the Word of God. And the text, he will come to Zion as Redeemer, to those in Jacob who turn from transgression, says Yahweh. This is my covenant with them, says Yahweh. My Spirit that is upon them, and my words that I've put in your mouth shall not depart out of your mouth or out of the mouths of your children or out of the mouths of your children's children, says Yahweh, from now on and forever. And a concluding comment and then some music. Chapters 56 to 59, which is what we've done in this period, conclude with the servants of this school staking their claim to have been given the spirit of prophecy, the word in their lips, and it's going to be in their children's children. This is the spirit given to Moses. Moses was succeeded by Joshua. In exile, the Isaiah school inherited this prophetic spirit, and now their children are carrying on the tradition. I'll play for you.